European allies when they refused to follow his policy.
Thank you very much. We're fresh out of time. Elijah Magner, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Edward Horgan, peace activist and former UN peacekeeper from Limerick, Ireland. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Next, you will hear recitation of verse 21 of chapter Ibrahim from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Reza Yan.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa barazu lillahi jami'an faqala ضعفاء للذين استكبروا إنا كنا لكم تبعا فهل أنتم مغنون عنا من عذاب الله من شيء قالوا سواء المحيص صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And they shall all come forth before Allah. Then the weak shall say to those who were proud, surely we were your followers. Can you therefore avert from us any part of the chastisement of Allah? They would say, if Allah had guided us, we too would have guided you. It is the same to us whether we are impatient now or patient. There is no place for us to fly to.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines, Ayatollah Khamenei urges the Iranian nation to remain united in the face of enemy plots aimed at bringing the Islamic Republic to its knees. Search and rescue operations continue in Turkey and Syria following powerful quakes as an unknown number of people remain trapped under the debris. Russia warns the UK against sending fighter jets to Ukraine, saying the move will have serious military and political consequences for the entire world. Hello and welcome, everybody. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution warns the Iranian nation about the enemy's plot to bring the Islamic Republic to its knees by creating discord and mistrust within the people. Ayatollah Khamenei said the enemy has employed various tactics to pursue its strategy of driving a wedge among the Iranians. The enemy's major tactic, as the leader added, is spreading lies and rumors. Ayatollah Khamenei also said Iran's foes claim they're not seeking to subvert the Islamic Republic, while the conspiracies they've hatched over the years prove otherwise. The leader mentioned the reason for the enemy's efforts to eradicate the Islamic Republic as well. He said that's because Iran has cut their access to the West Asia region. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks in a meeting with Iranian Air Force commanders and personnel. The meeting was held on the anniversary of the historic allegiance of the Iranian Air Force with the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, in 1979. And Russia is hosting another security meeting to address the situation in Afghanistan. Participants mainly from Iran, India, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and China have proposed several practical measures to address problems in the war-torn country. Our correspondent Marina Kortunova reports from Moscow.
The fifth meeting of security representatives from several countries to address Afghanistan problems has been held in the Russian capital, Moscow. Participants have come up with a number of practical measures to take joint actions in the fight against terrorism. The measures include curbing terrorism finances, intensifying cooperation in the field of combating transnational organized crime, illegal arms and drug trafficking, and preventing illegal migration. The measures come at a time when the U.S. authorities are using the frozen Afghan assets as a tool to blackmail the country. In December, Russia's permanent representatives to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, called on Washington to immediately return the funds stolen from the Afghan people. He called the U.S. freezing of Afghanistan's assets outrageous. This, as Afghan authorities are still reaping the fruits of chaos left by the Americans, and the situation in the socio-economic sphere is rapidly degrading.
Washington, London, and their allies continue to freeze Afghan assets illegally instead of allocating them for humanitarian works, Moreover, attempts are being made by Western countries to plunder the funds, including by setting aside part of them to pay compensation to relatives of September 11 attacks victims, in which the Afghan people were not involved.
The Iranian representatives called the situation in Afghanistan a consequence of the U.S. policy.
Iran is a country hosting the largest number of refugees from Afghanistan. They are provided with a variety of opportunities, including higher education through state subsidies. Approximately 300,000 to 350,000 children from Afghanistan study in our schools, and about 6,000 Afghans study at Iranian universities. We do not have any camps for refugees. Afghans live on an equal footing with other Iranian citizens. We do not make any discriminatory distinction between Iranian and Afghan students. Moreover, given the difficult economic situation in Afghanistan, we grant scholarships to refugee families for the education of their children.
The secretaries of national security of the participant countries described the U.S. strategy in Afghanistan as pre-planned and prepared. Under the pretext of fighting the terrorist group that Washington itself created, the U.S. wants to force Afghanistan's neighboring countries to open their doors to American bases. That's a policy aimed at expanding the U.S. presence in the region. Such meetings are seen as an attempt to neutralize and contain the U.S. approach. The Moscow format on Afghanistan was created in 2017 that brought together Russia, Afghanistan, China, Pakistan, Iran, and India. Later, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan joined as well. Participants have so far held several meetings aimed at helping Afghanistan, which has been devastated by years of the U.S.-led war. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Search and rescue teams continue to pull survivors from the debris 3 days after massive quakes hit Syria and Turkey, killing over 15,000 people. Already hampered by freezing weather, relief operations move slowly due to the mere scale of the disaster. According to official figures, over 12,000 people have died in Turkey and nearly 3,000 in Syria. The toll is expected to further increase as unknown number of people remain trapped under thousands of buildings flattened by the quake. Survivors in southern Turkey and in Syria are now spending a third night in the freezing cold. Dozens of countries have pledged to help while rescue teams as well as relief supplies have already arrived.
In Syria, destruction has become a familiar scene for the people. The 7.8 magnitude earthquake which hit Turkey and northern Syria continues to claim more lives as many remain stuck under the rubble in the cities of Aleppo and Latakia. Thousands of people lost their lives or became homeless due to the collapse of residential buildings. Russia, Iran, and the UAE were among the first countries to send urgent humanitarian assistance.
The number of displaced people due to the earthquake has reached nearly 300,000. We established 180 shelters. This situation is difficult considering our capabilities, and the cold weather is also exacerbating the situation. We hope countries provide necessary rescue assistance.
Makhlouf was speaking in a press conference in Damascus. He thanked countries that offered help. He also lashed out at the U.S. and Western countries for not lifting economic sanctions during such a harsh humanitarian crisis.
U.S. and Western sanctions on Syria have deprived the country from having necessary equipment such as medicine, food, and fuel in such circumstances. Our suffering is mainly caused by either terrorism or sanctions imposed by countries supporting terrorism in Syria. U.S. claims that their sanctions do not affect humanitarian assistance are false.
The war on Syria has severely damaged the country's critical infrastructure, including 50,000 public vehicles that could have been used in rescue operations. Sanctions have left Syria unable to replace those vehicles or import basic food and medical needs. Shortages in fuel due to the U.S. occupation of oil fields, as well as lack of electricity, create unprecedented challenges for the Syrian government. It is yet another disaster that has exacerbated the suffering of the Syrian people. This time, it's not related to the war, but has left thousands of people devastated. Syrians are calling on the U.S. and its Western allies to end politicizing humanitarian issues. Hamad Ali from the Ministry of Local Administration, Damascus.
Staying with the story, the fourth Iranian plane carrying humanitarian aid has landed in Aleppo International Airport in northwestern Syria. The latest batch of Iran's aid included tents and a variety of foodstuff. Officials say Iran will send more humanitarian supplies to Syria in the coming days. Earlier, Tehran had urged the international community to put pressure on the U.S. to lift its cruel sanctions on Syria to facilitate aid deliveries. The unlawful sanctions have hampered international efforts to assist Syrian victims of Monday's powerful quakes. Well, the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo has once again sparked outrage, this time over a cartoon mocking the catastrophic earthquakes that have recently hit Turkey and Syria.
Charlie Hebdo published a cartoon on his Twitter account showing a damaged building, a toppled car, and a heap of rubble with a caption reading, "No need to send tanks." Social media users slammed Charlie Hebdo for mocking the tragedy that has claimed the lives of thousands of people in the two countries. They described the illustration as insensitive and tasteless. Critics also argue that the cartoon dehumanizes Muslims as victims in every way. In a similar move in 2016, the magazine published a cartoon portraying the victims of a quake in Italy as pasta dishes, also sparking online anger. The cartoon showed a pile of dead bodies labeled as lasagna. The hardest-hit Italian town of Amatrice is famous for producing a tomato-based pasta sauce. Back then, social media users expressed disgust at the caricature. The Italian Minister of Justice also condemned the magazine. Charlie Hebdo has been criticized for stirring up hatred under the pretext of freedom of speech and making light of tragedies in the West Asia region.
Russia has issued a stern warning to Britain about sending fighter jets to Ukraine. Moscow says the move would have serious military and political ramifications for Europe and the entire world. The Russia embassy to Britain said Moscow will find a way to respond to any unfriendly steps taken by the UK. The reaction came after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky met with British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak in London. During a press conference, Sunak was asked about providing Kiev with fighter jets.
So when it comes to fighter combat aircraft, of course they are part of the conversation. Indeed, we've been discussing that today and have been previously, and that's why we've announced today that we will be training Ukrainian Air Force on NATO standard platforms. Because the first step in being able to provide advanced aircraft is to have soldiers or aviators that are capable of using them. That is a process that takes some time. We've started that process today. That's because we're keen to support the president and his country in delivering a victory. And nothing is off the table. And our leadership on this issue.
Sunak said the UK will arm and train Ukrainian troops with the equipment they need to fight back Russian forces. He added that London is accelerating the delivery of military equipment to ensure it reaches Ukraine front lines within the coming days and weeks. Moscow has repeatedly accused the West of trying to prolong the conflict by supplying Ukraine with billions of dollars worth of advanced military equipment. We've discussed the UK Prime Minister's meeting with Ukrainian President and Kiev's demand for fighter jets in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Our correspondent Amina Taylor joins us from London to give us the latest on this visit. Greg Simmons is a researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies, who joins us from Uppsala, Sweden, for an analysis. Okay, welcome to you both. Amina, let me first start with you. Tell us more about what Zelensky has said, what he, I'm sure, has requested, and also the venue of where this took place and what that symbolizes.
Well, if there were any doubt, Kaveh, that the British state apparatus is very much in favor of the Ukrainian position in this conflict, then you need not look any further than the rapturous welcome that Zelensky was given by British parliamentarians from both sides of the aisle. I mean, they can't agree on, you know, how to end strike action here. They can't agree on ending austerity or trying to do something to deal with this cost of living crisis, but they can all agree that the celebrity commander in chief in the form of Zelensky is greeted in this fashion. I mean, I will touch on the fact that he was at Buckingham Palace to meet Charles III later, but this is very much the drive in the Zelensky-Ukraine machine here to drum up more support. Anytime there is any visual aids here that Russia may be advancing, or the conflict might not be going the way the West might have hoped, and not as quickly as they would have hoped, then we get these surprise visits. We had the situation in Washington just a few weeks ago. Britain became the second country to greet Zelensky on these surprise mission. He's now on his way to Paris for more of the same. I mean, it is very difficult to look at the way in which Downing Street first, as you mentioned in your introduction there, talked of the increasing sanctions that it was trying to level on Russian interests, though I can't understand where there'd be more sanctions to be found, if I'm honest, since everything is being squeezed within an inch of its life, if it has any kind of Russian connections. Russophobia is at its highest level. And I think you see that it's coming from the state down. You know, very few Brits would have known the name Volodymyr Zelensky before the beginning of this conflict. But the way in which his reputation as this wartime leader is being amplified, and the different pledges that Britain is making as a country, more armaments, more support for its troops, the Marines being trained, soldiers being trained, I can't see how this can be anything other than a road to further escalation. Why would you not want to de-escalate this crisis, not turn it into a race into who can throw more munitions and support at Ukraine? I simply don't understand the logic here, Kav.
All right, Greg Simmons, taking a look at one aspect of this, which perhaps is not really perhaps touched on that much while Amina was talking there, that came to my mind to ask you, and that is how we see Zelensky come into these high-profile venues in order to make his presence known. Okay, so today we saw the venue that he was in, and then weeks prior to that when he made his trip to the U.S. I think in some opening bells down in Wall Street, he's also made appearances. I think he's also made appearances at the Oscars, if I'm not mistaken, and different types of venues where the masses are watching. Is that a way for the governments that are involved to tell the people or to highlight Ukraine in the way that they need to, so that they can push out the aid to or extend the aid to Ukraine, so that the ordinary Main Street doesn't get too angry and frustrated based on their own economic conditions? Is that one way, perhaps, of looking at this?
Well, I think you need to look at it from the perspective of political marketing. And this political marketing is trying to market Zelensky as some kind of Churchill, this brave wartime commander who's standing up to the world. I mean, this was exactly what the British and the Americans did to Winston Churchill before the United States got involved in the Second World War. They needed to sell the person in order to garner public support. But, I mean, if one looks at the effect, well, I mean, that Churchill went to the United States as Zelensky is going to the United Kingdom, I mean, it ended Churchill and Britain as being any kind of subject and turned it into an object, because they're going as a junior. They're going with cap in hand saying, please, sir, can I have some more? And this is what it is. It's a begging to try and drum up some political support and some military weapons, which are going to be second rate and not really alter the outcome, which is going to be soon decided.
Unfortunately, we just don't have the time, but thank you very much for that. Amina Taylor there, of course, correspondent from London, from Uppsala, Sweden. We appreciate it. Greg Simmons, researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in.
Moving on, Russia slapped sanctions on nearly 80 U.S. politicians and officials in a retaliatory move for Washington's hostile actions. The Russian sanctions list includes 33 governors of U.S. states and a series of other mid-ranking state and federal officials. The people on the list are permanently barred from entering Russia. Moscow says the move is in response to Washington's support for Kiev and the West's unprecedented sanctions against Russia. The United States and its allies, including Britain and the European Union, have added hundreds of Russia's political and business elites to their sanctions list since Moscow started the war on Ukraine. Last February, Western countries have frozen assets, have blacklisted Russians while banning them from entering their territories. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Limelight. Britain's economy has faced many challenges in recent years. The withdrawal of the country from the European Union and the expenses caused by the control of the coronavirus pandemic caused the economy to be about 20% smaller than in 2020. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, rejected calls to prevent sharp rises in domestic energy bills for all households in his March budget, meaning millions of Britons will see costs soar by about 40% from April. Instead, Jeremy Hunt will claim the extra support he's giving to the poorest and most vulnerable households, including those on benefits, in what he will describe as a more fairly targeted system of support. Demands for the Treasury to halt a planned rise in the energy price guarantee, the discounted cost of gas and electricity to consumers from £2,500 to £3,000 a year for the average household in the March budget, have been growing in recent weeks, particularly as the whole wholesale cost of energy has been falling. Because an additional £400 of extra government help with energy costs for all households made in monthly payments since October also ends in March, the effective rise for all but those under lowest incomes will be about 40%. Calls for the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, to stop the rise in the energy price guarantee have been led by consumer champion Martin Lewis, founder of the website MoneySavingExpert.com, who has said the move would be an obvious rabbit out of the hat that the Chancellor could afford to pull out of his red box in March. The Labour Party, meanwhile, has also been calling for the rise in the energy price guarantee to be stopped and for the extra cost to the government of doing so to be met through the proceeds of a more punitive windfall tax on the vast profits of energy companies. But Treasury insiders have told The Observer that the move is not under consideration, partly because Treasury receipts from its own windfall tax on energy companies have been less than expected, and because of worries about exposing taxpayers to future market rise. Ruling out the move, a Treasury source said, while gas prices have fallen in recent months, they are still five times higher than the historical average and can just as easily increase. The source added, if the gas price spikes, the government will need to borrow billions of pounds more, while the energy price guarantee will continue to insulate millions of households from even higher wholesale gas prices. We need to reduce the taxpayer exposure to market volatility. Insulating every household and on an open-ended basis could have major implications for the public finances. Officials said that at the time of the autumn statement last November, the Treasury's own estimate for the proceeds of the windfall tax over 5 years was £55 billion. But because of recent falls in energy prices, this total has fallen by £25 billion and was now anticipated to come in closer to £30 billion. Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves said the prospect of such steep rises for most households was frightening and shameful at a time when energy giants were reaping huge profits. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a report, households in England and Wales will see the largest increase to their water bills in almost 20 years from this April, when they rise to an average of £448 a year. Industry body Water UK said the 7.5% increase would see customers pay around £1.23 per day on average, an increase of 8 pence per day, or an average of £31 more on last year's charges. Consumer groups warned the rise could prove the tipping point for one in five customers already struggling to pay. But Water UK claimed the water bills remained lower in real terms than they were a decade ago and said this year's increase reflected higher energy costs, with water firms using around 2% of the nation's electricity. It announced firms were set to invest a further £70 billion to eliminate harm from storm overflows and increase water supplies by building new reservoirs and national water transfer schemes, claiming that they were acutely aware of the impact of price rises on lower income and vulnerable customers and had recently increased the level of support they offered by more than £200 million. Water UK Director of Policy Stuart Colville said, "With an average increase of around 60 pence a week, most customers will again see a below-inflation increase in their water bill. However, we know that any increase is unwelcome, particularly at the moment." The Consumer Council for Water announced regional variations and factors such as whether a customer is metered and how much water they use meant some households could face rises significantly above or below the average. The Consumer Council for Water Chief Executive Emma Clancy said, "Water is essential for all of us, so no one should be worried about being able to afford their bill. These increases will bring more uncertainty to struggling households at a time when they can't be certain that they will get the help that they need." Emma Clancy added, "Low-income households need immediate relief and the long-term security of knowing their water bill will be affordable. It is not fair that struggling households face a postcode lottery when it comes to getting help with their water bill. That's why we urgently need a new water affordability scheme that provides consistent support based on people's needs." The website MSN.com has also covered the same story and tells us more. The impending recession could leave borrowers struggling to repay their debts, the high street bank Santander UK said as it put aside more cash to protect itself from potential defaults. The UK arm of the Spanish bank said recently that while the outlook for Britain's economy remained uncertain, a recession in 2023 was likely. It said that despite government support for energy bills, rising prices would continue to eat away at disposable income, which could impact lending repayments. The warning was issued alongside the bank's full-year results, which showed the lender put aside £321 million in 2022 to cover potential defaults, compared with the £233 million it released a year earlier as COVID restrictions began to lift. The higher figure was because of the deterioration in the economic environment, including higher interest rates, lower economic growth, and a drop in house prices, which Santander predicts will fall by about 10% to levels not seen since 2021. The bank said, "These challenges for households and businesses are expected to continue into 2023 and could impact credit quality," referring to the ability of borrowers to repay their loans and mortgages. On Wednesday, Virgin Money set aside £66 million to cover a possible rise in bad debts in the first quarter of this year. However, the Challenger Bank said repayments had been stable so far. Santander's provision for potential defaults weighed on the lender's profits, which rose just 2% to nearly £1.9 billion over the year to December. The flat growth was despite a 12% increase in net interest income to £4.5 billion, as the interest rate rise allowed it to charge more for mortgages and loans. Profits were also subdued by the £421 million it put aside to cover the cost of fraud and scams, as well as a £108 million regulatory fine from the Financial Conduct Authority. In December, the UK regulator issued the bank with a penalty over serious and persistent gaps in its anti-money laundering controls between 2012 and 2017. Santander UK said it was also affected by a marked slowdown in mortgage lending at the end of the year as interest rates increased to 3.5%.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خان که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبریز.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution.
Revolution of 79.
That the Americans didn't learn about it
because there was an
the Shahs
that also talked to a number of people.
Mohammad Reza Shah had a tough time during the mid-1978. He was straining every nerve to keep his relations with the Carter administration. But the United States didn't seem to grasp the gravity of the situation in Iran.
I don't know enough about Jimmy Carter's mindset. Maybe Gary Zick does. I mean, I don't know if Jimmy Carter really said to himself, if we got rid of the Shah of Iran, everything would be terrific in Iran, because we'll bring about a democratic, libertarian, you know, secular government. Or whether Jimmy Carter didn't realize what he was saying, or thought that the Shah was so strong and powerful a character like Ferdinand Marcos that this stuff would go over big in the United States, but it wouldn't matter to the Shah. The latter is my guess, is that Carter had no understanding of how weak the Shah was.
I was the person that was responsible for reporting to the President of the United States about what was going on. I wasn't the only person, but I was the principal. That was my job. And I wrote memos saying, you know, there are demonstrations, there are problems, we're seeing signs that things are not going well, it doesn't seem to be getting better. But I do remember vividly in August of 1978, which was quite a long ways into it, though the biggest demonstrations hadn't happened yet, Ambassador Sullivan was on vacation and came home, and I took him into the White House to see Mr. Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor. And I was in the room with Brzezinski and Sullivan, and Sullivan said to him, you know, Brzezinski asked him, what's going on in Iran, and you know, what's the situation? And he said, don't worry about it. The Shah has it all under control, and you have nothing to worry about.
Set against such a drop, the Shah appointed Jafar Sharif Emomi as his prime minister. His close connection to the clergy had made him the successful candidate in a competition with more qualified rivals. The appointment was a desperate attempt to restore peace to the country, winning the vote of confidence. Sharif Emomi told the parliament about his plan for national reconciliation. By September 1978, the Shah had changed his tune on public demonstrations. He called for martial law in the capital city of Tehran and other big cities. Demonstrations were proscribed, nighttime curfew was imposed, and arrest warrants were issued for opposition leaders. On September 8, 1978, the faint hope of reconciliation between the protest movement and the Shah's regime vanished when a great number of demonstrators were slaughtered near Jale Square in Tehran. The day was called Black Friday.
Forget, he was pretty stupid during this period, too. Instead of going to his cherished allies for 30 years and saying, look, I've got a problem, he was attempting to deal with them in his own land. In fact, the guy he picked as Deputy Inspector General of Imperial Guard had been a Khomeini guy for 5 years, you know, or maybe 3 years, but he went straight to Khomeini. That's why the rapprochement with the religious leaders that he tried for in the spring of 78 didn't work, because the guy that was running it from his shop was running to screw it up on Khomeini's benefit.
I believe that the secret of understanding the Shah is to understand that, in fact, the Shah was a very weak personality who had a very low sense of self-worth, of self-esteem. He was not a powerful character. And the result of that was that he was, partially for good reasons, partially for not so good reasons, eternally fearful of being overthrown. I mean, one has to remember that his father was overthrown by foreign powers. One has to remember that he was the subject of an assassination attempt in which bullets actually entered his body. So that would make one pretty fearful of future assassination attempts. That was in 1949. One has to remember that in 1953, the United States overthrew Mossadegh with the cooperation of the British. Not quite clear what the role of the CIA was, what the role of the British was, but all that to the aside, and brought the Shah back to power. So if we were able to get rid of Mossadegh, we could probably get rid of the Shah. And he was always concerned about the fact that, in fact, he was not sufficiently important to America that he would be guaranteed to be kept in power.
The country had passed the point of no return. In a span of 4 months, from October 1978 to January 1979, momentous events happened just to accelerate the downfall of the Shah. The period was marked by widespread opposition, massive strikes, and demonstrations through the whole country. During this period of time, the Shah's men left the country one by one, and soon the Shah found himself alone, in deep depression, and under the world's media spotlight. This time, the United States seemed to be a fair-weather friend of the Shah.
The Shah came to the United States for medical treatment in what have been, I guess, late 1979, early 1980, somewhere. Helms went to see him in the hospital in New York. And the first thing the Shah said to him was, why did you Americans turn against me? So certainly by the time the revolution got underway, he had his doubts about us. And I think it affected his ability to manage the crisis.
Sharif Emomi began a policy of meeting the opposition's demands before being made. He did away with the unpopular Rastakhiz Party and announced all political parties in the country legal. Hundreds of political prisoners were released and freedom of expression became a civil right. The Prime Minister also curtailed Samak's powers and closed down casinos and nightclubs. The imperial calendar was also abolished. During the heyday of the Rastakhiz Party, Mohammad Reza Shah once said, "The party will include all people of Iran, except those who are rebellious." Politically inept, the Sharif Emomi administration was unable to appease the angry opposition. And as for the Americans, they hadn't reached a consensus on what attitude they had to take towards the revolution. The disagreement between Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, and Cyrus Vance, the Secretary of State, was just a case in point.
Most Americans couldn't find Iran on a map if they tried. They have absolutely no idea what's going on in Europe in the last 300 years. Americans are very, very, very parochial. I mean, their greatest interest is who's winning the Super Bowl or the World Series right now, what's happening to their personal health insurance. They just don't have any real appreciation for foreign cultures of any kind. And it's not just the people. I mean, large numbers of people in the put into public office don't get it. You know, I had a colleague that went in to see George Bush reasonably after the election and spent 45 minutes of his hour with Bush trying to explain the difference between Sunnis and Shiites and came out tearing his hair. And this was a fellow that got elected president. There's just a very, very limited understanding of, foreign nations and cultures. We're a superpower by the fact that we're a super economic power and a super military power. We're not a superpower in terms of foreign understanding.
Problem was you had a regime, an administration, I should say, the Carter administration, that had deeply divided counsel about countries like Iran.
What they did do is bring in a guy by the name of Stan Escudero, who was a later ambassador to, I think, Azerbaijan and one other country in the Caucasus after the breakup of the Soviet Union. And Escudero was a kind of a controversial figure in the sense that he had been an outspoken critic in the mid-70s of our support, essentially of putting all the American national security eggs in the Shah's basket.
The third problem was that the American embassy in Tehran was woefully ill-informed about what was going on the street.
And Escudero was critical of that. But it almost terminated his career because it ran counter to what then Secretary of State Kissinger was advocating, the U.S. policy and the Ford and tail end of the Nixon administration. But he was also a fluent Farsi speaker. And so when the revolution happened, Sullivan asked for Escudero, or somebody like Escudero comes in, to infiltrate the crowds, which he does, specifically to try to get a sense of what the ground truth is with the demonstrators. And Escudero ends up reporting back repeatedly with Sullivan on, he meets religious leaders, he meets student leaders, he gets a very good sense of the opposition to the Shah, reports back to Sullivan, and essentially convinced with Sullivan's views that the Shah's done. This is a widespread opposition movement. It goes across not only religious but all the stratas, from the bazaar to the Gom and the religious movement, and even in elements within the military.
By autumn, popular support for the revolution was to the maximum. Those against the revolution preferred not to speak out. That's while some predicted that the victory would be achieved in November. On the 6th of November 1978, General Ghulam Reza Azhari succeeded Sharif Emomi. A military government was the last hope.
A month later, General Azhari had a heart attack and he was in the hospital. And our ambassador Sullivan went to see him. While he was there, the general waved him over to his bedside and said, and he whispered in his ear, he said, "You know, the country is lost, for the king cannot make up his mind." And to me, I didn't hear about this until later, actually, but it is the single clearest description of the problem. The Shah had lots of assets at his command, lots of resources that he could use, and he couldn't make up his mind how to use them or to use them effectively.
On December 2nd, over 2 million people in Tehran took to the streets heading for Azadi Square. They called for the downfall of the Shah and the return of Imam Khomeini.
The time that almost everybody realized there was a problem and that maybe it had gone too far was at the time of the Ashwa-Teshwa riots in early December. News came out that they were going to have a massive demonstration. They said they were going to have it. The army threatened to stop it, and things were getting bad. And when the demonstrations took place, 1,200,000 people in the streets, and I did most of the count. I was experienced at Berkeley, where I used to count the demonstrators for the local press. About 1,200,000, no violence. And everybody concluded the Shah was gone.
A few days later, on December 10th and 11th, reportedly around 9 million people throughout the country staged large demonstrations. Even discounting for exaggeration, these figures may represent the largest protest event in history.
The world radically changed in 1979. I mean, even independent of the Iranian Revolution, you had the start of an Islamic century. You had the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which ultimately showed that a small sort of religious power could, in fact, challenge militarily a superpower and win. So the whole way the world was being perceived changed, and one key piece of it was the Iranian Revolution. So sort of nobody knew how to deal with this. We didn't, the Russians didn't. So the world radically changed in this very critical year of 1979.
By mid-December, the Shah's position had deteriorated to a point that he wanted only to be allowed to stay in Iran. But he was turned down by the opposition. In late December, he agreed to leave the country temporarily, and still, he was turned down. On January 16th, 1979, the Shah and his wife left Iran.
Do you expect the Shah to return to Iran? And if so,
I don't know, this is up to him.
Well, he says he's taking an extended vacation, and obviously he's leaving you with a lot of problems to try to solve. And
well, there's a power to ruin the country, too.
In the end, it was the Shah who was responsible, in the sense that I think he came to believe that the greatest obstacle to his realizing his great ambitions for his people, the country of Iran also, were the Iranian people. And if it weren't for them, everything would be great. Well, it's pretty hard for a king to stay in power when he thinks his people are the obstacle to the realization of his dreams to make a great country.
Scenes of spontaneous joy followed, and within hours, almost every sign of the Pahlavi dynasty was erased. February 1st, 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Iran in a chartered Air France Boeing 747. The welcoming crowd of several million Iranians was so large that he was forced to take a helicopter after the car he was being transported in from the airport was overwhelmed by an enthusiastic crowd. Now, the undisputed leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, was greeted with cries of Khomeini, O Imam, we salute you, peace be upon you, and Islam, Islam, Khomeini, we will follow you.
Limelight.
With the discovery of some highly confidential and sensitive documents from U.S. President Joe Biden's former private office and his home in Wilmington, Delaware, once again concerns about endangering American national security have increased. The majority of the American people expressed concern that the secret documents that Biden and former President Donald Trump illegally kept in their homes could potentially endanger some sources and methods of the American intelligence community. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. NBC News has covered this story and tells us more. A new survey has found that Americans are equally concerned about classified documents found in possession of President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump, even though the current and former presidents have handled their situations differently. An opinion poll released recently says 67% of respondents said they find the discovery of the Biden documents either very concerning or somewhat concerning, while an identical 67% held the same views about the discovery of the Trump documents. More than a dozen classified documents have been found at Joe Biden's residence and private office, while over 300 classified documents were recovered from Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence in Florida. Joe Biden and his lawyers claim they have so far cooperated with the Justice Department and allowed authorities to search his Wilmington, Delaware home, where six additional classified documents were found. However, Donald Trump resisted handing over the documents despite repeated requests from the National Archives and a subpoena, leading a judge to issue a warrant authorizing the FBI to search Mar-a-Lago in Florida. According to the survey, 50% of the respondents disapprove of Joe Biden's job performance, compared to 45% who approve. The survey also found that Americans are also concerned that the handling of the classified documents by Biden is consuming Republican members of Congress. 55% of respondents said they believe House Republicans spend too much time investigating Biden rather than focusing on other priorities. 54% of respondents said they believe Republicans will be too inflexible in their investigations. In the wake of the discovery of the documents in both Biden's and Trump's possession, the Justice Department told the Senate Intelligence Committee that it was actively working to brief lawmakers about the potential risk to national security. Assistant Attorney General Carlos Uriarte wrote in a letter to a number of senators that prosecutors on both matters are actively working to enable sharing information with the committee. However, both Republican and Democratic senators voiced frustration after they left a recent closed-door briefing with National Intelligence Director Avril Haines, who declined to show them copies of the classified documents. Sputnik news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a Redfield and Wilton Strategies poll, a total of 43% of U.S. citizens believe the classified documents that were found in President Joe Biden's home and former office were probably deliberately kept by him and or his staff. Meanwhile, 34% of those sampled think that the classified documents were kept there probably mistakenly, with another 23% undecided. The opinion poll also found that 32% of the respondents believe the story has been overblown. A further 65% of those polled are in favor of searches of all of Biden's properties by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. The survey was conducted from 28th to 29th of January among 1,500 eligible voters. On 9th of January, U.S. media reported that Joe Biden's personal attorneys discovered 10 classified documents pertaining to Ukraine, Iran, and the United Kingdom at his think tank's office, prompting a federal probe into the matter. Several new packages of classified official papers have been discovered in Joe Biden's personal home in Wilmington, Delaware, since then. The U.S. Department of Justice is investigating how classified documents relating to the period of Biden's vice presidency ended up in office and residential premises not authorized for their storage. Republican House members have charged U.S. authorities of hypocrisy when it comes to the handling of the classified documents by President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump after leaving office. Representative James Comer, Republican of Kentucky, the newly appointed chairman of the House Oversight and Accountability Committee, recently called Biden's Delaware residence a crime scene. James Comer.